Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD International Radio. I am Katie Jackson, and I will be your host this afternoon. Today, I would like to welcome Sharon Thomason to our show. Sharon Thomason is a Huntington's disease patient advocate extraordinaire. She has been living with Huntington's disease for over 30 years. Sharon was an educator for 38 years, and now she is retired and is a full-time caregiver for her son. I am very lucky that Sharon is my colleague at Help for HD International and a dear, dear friend of mine, so I'm very excited to have her on the show today. So welcome, Sharon.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
Yes, so let's start the show with you talking about when and how did HD enter into your life.
Okay. I fell in love with a man who had Huntington's disease in his family. And we got married in 1983. I knew it was in his family. I knew he was at risk. But the only thing that I knew about Huntington's was that it caused chorea. Mm-hmm. And after we got married, there started to be a lot of the behavioral symptoms that I now know are a part of Huntington's. And I reached out to the national organization. You know, this was before internet and before cell phones and all of that. So I wrote them a letter, an actual letter. And somehow that letter got lost. They were reorganizing mm-hmm. or something. And so months later, somebody called me. And there really wasn't much that they could tell me. There weren't any resources in our area. We were living in Louisiana, and they couldn't tell me much more than what I already knew, which was, you know, the movement disorder part. And then we had decided not to have children since Paul was at risk. And then he was working for an oil company on offshore oil rigs. And he would be out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and living on the rig. And so he came home from one of those stints real excited. And he had read the New Orleans Times-Picayune, had an insert called the Ochsner Report from the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans. And they had a piece in there about how they had a new procedure that could determine whether or not a fetus had any number of diseases, and it listed the different things it could determine, and Huntington's was one of them. And the procedure, which is common now but was new then, was chorionic villi sampling. So we talked about, you know, the implications of that. Well, if we did the test and the fetus tested positive, we would know that Paul had Huntington's, and was he ready to deal with that? And
right.
Would we go ahead with the pregnancy? And, you know, all of these mm-hmm. these things. And we talked about it. He was also in AA at the time, and we talked about it at some of those meetings. And, you know, just got a lot of feedback. And so we decided to go ahead and try, and within 2 weeks I was pregnant, and I called the Ochsner Clinic to set up an appointment, and they said, oh, we're so sorry, but that report was erroneous. We do have the chorionic villi sampling, but it will not tell you whether a fetus has Huntington's. There is no test for that. So this was in 1984, mm-hmm. before the before the gene. And so right. at that point, I was pregnant, and there was no test. And so we had to decide what to do. So we decided to go ahead with the pregnancy. And in August of 85, we had the most beautiful, healthy baby boy, and were just so excited, just over the moon. And, you know, Paul loved kids, and kids loved him. And he was he was so good with kids. And so it was a really good thing for him. But then he started having some symptoms, like his toes flipping and just kind of an odd gait. Not the chorea like what had been right. described to me, but, you know, and spilling things and dropping things. And so one day I was reading the local newspaper, the Tallahassee Democrat, and I saw a notice for a support group that was meeting in Thomasville, Georgia. Well, Thomasville, even though it's in Georgia and we're in Florida, we're real close to the state line, so it's only 30 or 40 minutes away from us. So we started going to that support group. And in that support group, I met two other people who had Huntington's, and everybody else was either a caregiver, a friend, a church member, a family member. But Paul didn't look like the other two men that had Huntington's. You know, he didn't
have the chorea.
He didn't have the chorea.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure. Yeah.
Let's see, I guess it was 1988. Because we were meeting in Georgia, we were connected with the Georgia chapter. And through them, we had access to the Huntington's Disease Clinic at Emory University in Atlanta. And so somebody in the group made arrangements for us to go up there and have Paul see a neurologist. And so we went up there, and they took an extensive family history, and they did an MRI. And he was real claustrophobic, so they had to give him Valium or something to so he could go in the MRI machine. And so we left there with a diagnosis that, yes, he had Huntington's disease. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I knew that our lives were just changed forever. You know, we weren't going to grow old together. I had read and heard stories that a lot of people with Huntington's ended up getting divorced so that they could qualify for help for their loved ones. So I didn't know if that was going to happen. I knew it meant that our son was at risk 50-50 for having the disease. So everything changed.
And I always been like, I sit in awe listening to you guys. I call you guys the pioneers, because to know, like, when my husband was diagnosed, it was going on the internet. I got to go on the internet. I pulled up Huntington's disease page after page. We went to our first clinic appointment. There were 7 clinical trials and studies going on. You know,
wow.
There was support groups galore. There was, you know, all this stuff. And I hear people speak about their journeys with HD, like you and Judy Roberson and these pioneers that
really, I can't even imagine, and the Guthries, and I can't even imagine what it must have been like to have absolutely no support.
And there, like I said, there was no internet at the time.
Right.
And if you looked in an encyclopedia or you went to the library and tried to find information, you might find a paragraph somewhere. And it would have the standard, you know, thing about, you know, onset is between ages 35 and 50. Didn't say anything mm-hmm. about the possibility that children could have it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't even worry about that. And
sure.
maybe that was a good thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, about juvenile Huntington's, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't yeah. even know that was something to worry about. And mm-hmm. then at some point I read somewhere that it had been diagnosed in people between ages, from the age of 2 to the age of 80. And
right.
that really gave me pause, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think we all remember the first time we heard about JHD, like when we have children. I think we all remember that, where we go.
Yeah.
That, you know, I remember the first time I heard about juvenile Huntington's because I didn't know either. I remember that it puts you, it stops you in your tracks. Cause
mm-hmm.
It's definitely.
Mm-hmm.
A, yeah. Yeah.
And eventually, Paul's behavior got so dangerous and so... Mm. Hard to live with. One of the things that happened, Randy hadn't picked up his toys, and Paul got mad at him, and he grabbed him around his neck and picked him up. And it left a bruise around his neck. And I took mm-hmm. him to the doctor, and the doctor checked him out and said he was okay, but he had to report it to DCF. And so here we had DCF knocking on our door, and I was looking at the possibility of having my child taken away. And, you know, luckily they closed the case without doing anything, but we had other things that happened. And Paul and I were in counseling together, and, you know, he was so charming and just the kind of person that never met a stranger. He could talk to anybody, and everybody loved him, and he could hide everything when we were at the counselor, and I felt like I was crazy. And one day I said something, and the counselor looked at me and he said, "My God, I have been telling you to be more flexible, and you have been bending over backwards so far the back of your head is touching the floor." And that was the first time that he really realized just how much I was walking on eggshells and how difficult things were. And we ended up getting a divorce, and we had shared custody, and Randy would go with his daddy, and I would worry the whole time he was gone. And Paul would do things like I would call to tell Randy good night, and Paul would answer the phone, and he'd say things to me like, "He's dead." And oh my God, how can you do that?
Right.
And so, and Paul was a big hunter and fisherman, and he loved to take Randy out with him. And I was already mm-hmm. worried about his driving, and then to think of him getting Randy in a boat or taking him out with guns was just terrifying.
Sure.
And so one night Paul called me and he said Randy had been in an accident in the boat and he had a gash across his forehead. And he was back at his home, and he said, what do I do? I said, take him to the emergency room.
Yeah, he didn't know to do that.
He didn't have a clue what to do. He knew Randy was hurt badly, mm-hmm. and he knew something had to be done, but he didn't know what to do. So I said, take him to the emergency room, and I'll meet you there. And when I got there, Paul was holding Randy, and Randy was as white as a sheet. He was 5 years old, and he reached out his little arm to me. And I grabbed him, and I ran into the emergency room with him. And they ended up having to call in a plastic surgeon to fix the gash on his forehead because it was so bad. Well, what had happened was Paul had let this 5-year-old start the outboard motor and drive the boat.
Mm.
And when Randy started the motor, he gave it too much gas and the boat thrust forward and it threw him out of the seat and he landed in the boat, thank God. Not in the water, and
right.
As he was landing, he hit his face on the jagged edge of an aluminum rod holder, and that's how he had gashed his forehead. So at that end, got an order of supervised visitation, and of course, that meant doing a lot of trying to provide proof that this wasn't just some freak accident, that this was the result of the cognitive impairment of Huntington's disease. So,
well, later on in life, your son, because your husband Paul passed away.
Right.
And Randy
decided to test while Paul was still alive. When Randy turned 18, he decided he wanted to have the genetic test. Now, of course, that had been developed in 93, and we were all so excited, and they were telling us, oh, it'll be 10 years till we have a cure, and, here it was. 10 years later, and Randy was turning 18 and deciding to be tested, and we went back to Emory where his daddy had been diagnosed, and he went through about an hour's counseling session, and they said they thought he could handle it, and they would draw the blood right then if he wanted to do it. And he said yes, and they drew the blood. And a month later, they called us back, and we got the results, CAG repeat of 45. And the one thing, Randy was so brave. He was so strong. And I was the one that just fell apart, just collapsed.
Sure.
We had some friends that had gone with us, and I just collapsed in their arms. And Randy just handled it like, I hate to use this expression, but like a man,
took
it like a man. And the one thing he said was that he didn't want anybody to tell his daddy, and he just didn't want Paul to know. He didn't want him to have to deal with that. And let's see, we got his results. He did the test in 03, or he decided in 03, and he did the test in January of 04, and then we got the results in February, and then Paul died in October without ever knowing that Randy had inherited it.
We'll come back to Randy in a little bit, but the next question I have for you is, why are you such a strong patient advocate? I admire so much what you do. You know, I work by your side daily. So what makes you drive to be such a strong patient advocate?
Well, first of all, thank you for that. I think the main thing is that it's my way of coping. You know, when you're dealing with Huntington's, it is so out of your control. There's nothing you can do about it unless you're a researcher. There is absolutely nothing you can do about it, except try to educate people and try to raise awareness. And I want people who are just coming into this, who are just starting their own journeys, to know the things that I didn't know. And I want people who have absolutely nothing, you know, no connection to Huntington's, I want them to know about it, because I think the more awareness there is, the more push there will be to find a cure. And our loved ones with Huntington's need acceptance. They end up being so isolated because people don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, and the person looks a little odd or acts a little odd, and people are uncomfortable, and I don't want that for my son. I don't want him to be isolated.
Yeah, the society, the societal impact, the social impact is so great, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always been such a stigma. There are a lot of families that have hidden the disease because of the stigma, mainly because of the psychiatric and behavioral components.
Right,
And we just, as a society, need better acceptance, and we need to get rid of that stigma.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with that. Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you know, I was going to say the other thing about patient advocacy is that it has allowed me to network with so many people. People who are right there in the trenches with us, you know, other people who are dealing with the same things. And so if I have a question, you know, they're my experts, not the doctors.
Yeah.
We don't have a single doctor here in town who specializes in Huntington's. We're the capital city of Florida, and we have no doctor who specializes in Huntington's. And when we first started having problems, we would go to the neurologist, and the neurologist said, well, you need to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist would say, well, you need to see a neurologist. And, I felt like a ping-pong ball being bounced back and forth, back and forth. And just not getting the help. And so we need to educate the medical community just as well as we need to educate the general public.
Sure. Yeah, and that's your patient advocate role that since I've been a colleague of yours and we've been doing this together, I've seen you do so much. Like, you've been in, you've attended so many conferences, you spoke in front of the FDA, you've been in
high intensity documentary. So we have a face documentary. You've done so much. But my personal favorite activity thing that you have done, it's been with Help for HD International, of course, and that was you editing Life Interrupted. So I'd like to talk a little bit about Life Interrupted. You are a managing editor for HD International, and Life Interrupted was a kind of just an idea, and you really brought Life Interrupted to life. So I want to kind of talk about your journey with Life Interrupted and what it was like not only being a writer for Life Interrupted, but what it was like editing the whole book.
Okay. Well, it started with a phone call from you and Melissa Biliardi, and I think it was one of those midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning phone calls.
Yes.
Sharon, we have this idea, and we want to know what you think about it.
Right.
It just sounded like such a fabulous thing for Help for HD to do, and then the next thing I knew it was, will you edit it? And yeah, I can do that. I guess all those years of teaching English and journalism really prepared me for it, because it's like coaching students when they're writing and figuring out how to make your chapter the most effective, maybe rearranging some things or elaborating here or that, it was a really good experience to edit it, but it was also an exhausting experience because the stories are so heart-wrenching that by the time I finished editing one person's chapter, I would just feel totally drained.
I remember. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the chapters would come in, we would receive them at the same time, and I just remember sitting at my computer screen, I'd have to leave sometimes because I'd be bawling. I couldn't even read the screen anymore. And I remember after you would edit, you'd have to take a couple days before you went to the next chapter and just kind of sleep. And because it was such an emotional roller coaster ride, editing Life Interrupted.
Yeah.
But what
it,
an amazing,
it really was.
Amazing. Yeah. But what an amazing
outcome. Oh, the stories are just such an act of courage. For anybody who hasn't read it, we have stories from 12 different people who have lived with Huntington's disease, either as patients or as caregivers. And each one tells their own story in their own voice. And the experiences they're amazing, they're heart-wrenching, it's just this raw truth that is so telling. I think for anybody, not just people in the HD community, I mean, we start out with a chapter by Lisa Davenport, who started on a search for her birth mother. She had been adopted as an infant, and she did just this amazing search. And I knew about her story from talking to her on Facebook.
Right.
I thought that her story would be a really compelling one to share. And, man, what a story.
Such an amazing story. And the perseverance, the pushing on that she shows. And that was the one thing about every chapter of Life Interrupted is the bravery that just rings out. You know, I mean, these people,
absolutely.
It's heartbreaking as it is, and the
the what they are dealing with in their life, but the brave, the courage, and how they're soldiers. You know, it's marching on, it's going on, and it totally shows what our HD community is about. Is that we have, you know, we have Huntington's in our life, but we are all we are soldiers. We have to be, and
there's no choice.
Yeah.
People ask me, how do you do this? Or they say, you're so strong. And that's not it. I'm not strong. I don't feel like I'm strong. I'm just doing what I have to do. I don't feel like there's any other option.
We're survivors.
Right? Yeah.
So
besides
being
survivors, we're warriors. You know, we're warriors for our loved ones. We have to be their voice because they cannot be their own voice. We have to learn to navigate the social security system, the health care system, the mental health care system, and each one is so daunting that I don't know how people do it that don't have an advocate to help them. And that's why we have so many in the Huntington's community who are homeless. You know, they don't have anybody to be their voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not going to let that happen to my son. You know, I'm going to be his voice.
Yeah.
And I know you're the same way. You have done so much with all the clinical trials and the banking the cord blood when your youngest child was born, and you know, just so many things that you do to be a voice for Mike and your kids.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that I love our caregivers and our HD community. I think that I think we all are. And I love our HD community as a whole. The caregivers are just they love their loved ones so much, and we're fighting so hard for them. And I mean, I love Mike more than anything in this world, and I will continue my fight. And that is for sure. And I know you will too. That's what we do. In the chat room, we just got a comment that I just want to say. It says, such a heart-rending show. Sharon, you are such a wonderful advocate. Thank you for telling your story. Speaking of courage, you are a super warrior. As Melissa just typed in, she's listening from a doctor's appointment, I believe. So, let's talk about the new genetic psychiatric medicine test that you just went through. And before we talk about that, let's talk about what led you to do this test, and then we'll talk about the test itself.
Okay. Randy had, my son, had a lot of psychiatric symptoms, and we've been through, you know, a lot of Bacharachs, a lot of hospitalizations, and it had ended up since 2014, so about a year and a half. He's been living with me, and we have an excellent support system through a program here in Florida called FACT. It stands for Florida Assertive Community Training, and it's a grant-funded community mental health program, and it's not just here in Tallahassee, it's throughout Florida. And So they started out coming out to the house to see Randy every day, and they would bring his medication every day. And we would see their psychiatrist once a week, and he would go to a group therapy once a week. And then, you know, they've gradually stepped it down to where they bring his meds once a week, and he sees the psychiatrist generally once a month, more often if needed, and he goes to a group session once a week. And so he gets that socialization. And regardless of how closely they were working with him and how hard they were trying to get the medications straightened out, he had increasing anxiety to the point where he couldn't leave the house. The only thing he would leave the house for would be to go to the doctor or to go to group, because he knew he had to do those things. It was, you know, court-ordered things. So he would leave and do that, but he wouldn't go to a restaurant. He couldn't go into a store. He wouldn't go to a movie. He wouldn't go anywhere with friends. And he pretty much isolated himself in his room. I would try to watch TV with him, and he would last maybe 20 minutes, and then he'd say, "I'm going to bed." And sometimes his anxiety would be so bad that he would just sleep all day. He said it made him just physically exhausted. And so they kept increasing. They had him on Paxil, which is supposed to be good for depression and anxiety. And they kept increasing that, and he was getting worse. So they said, "Well, we've got this genetic medicine test that we do. It's called GeneSight, GeneSight. And they said if Randy was willing to do it, they would do that and see what medications would work the best for him based on his genetic makeup. Well, the test results came back, and with the psychotropic drugs, they have it broken down into antidepressants, anxiolytics and hypnotics, antipsychotics, and mood stabilizers. And within each category, they have three columns. They have drugs that will work well for the person based on their genetic makeup, use as directed. These drugs are good. And then there's a caution section, a list of drugs that you can use with caution, but there's going to be a moderate gene-drug interaction. And then there's a column of drugs to avoid because there's a significant gene-drug interaction. Well, wouldn't you know, Paxil was the only one on the list of the drugs to absolutely avoid. So they had kept increasing that, thinking they were helping him, but he was getting worse. And so they took him off of that, and they put him on, there were two that were in the good column for him, and one of those was Pristiq. So they put him on that, and the other things that he was on were good. They were in the good column, and or else in the middle column. And so they left him on everything else, changed the antidepressant, increased the Zyprexa a little bit because the Pristiq tended to elevate his mood a little bit, increased his Depakote a little bit, and also gave him Clonopin. And, you know, he's out of his room. He's coming out of the house. He actually went out of town with me last week and spent two nights away from home at our friend's house. And we went out to a restaurant, sat out on the dock by the bay, and had lunch. And, you know, he was able to do things he hasn't been able to do in months. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the test. It may not work for everybody.
Sure.
They did another test, too, that it was part of the same thing, but it showed how his genotype and phenotype metabolizes folic acid. And this is something called an MTHFR gene. And what it showed is that his body has a reduced folic acid conversion. So So they put him on, they call it a medical food. It's like the super vitamin gel cap. And it has folate in different forms. It has the different B vitamins, B12, B6, B1, 2, and 3. It has coenzyme Q10, magnesium, zinc. And so he's taking that in addition to the medications that he's on.
Okay, for absorption. How interesting. Well, and you know, and as always, you know, if this is something that you're struggling with as a caregiver, you know, always consult your physician and let them know, you know, they're the experts and they'll know, and let them talk to them about, you know, be your own advocate and talk to your physician if you're having troubles and struggles, and they may put you in for a test like this, or they may, you know, I think the biggest thing is that we wait so long as caregivers, and because we just don't know, and I'm so guilty of this, and you know, I think to always be in communication at all times. I know that people struggle with that with their neurologists in the Huntington's disease community. I'm very fortunate to have Dr. Wheelock here at UC Davis, but I hear all the time of people struggling, but don't stop, keep going. You know, you have to bang down walls, but keep being your advocate for your loved one, because maybe something like this may help.
Take the information to the doctors, share it with them, because you know, they may not have ever heard some of the things that we know about as a community.
Right. Yep. Yes, definitely. Well, I think we're coming down to our time. Is there anything else, Sharon, you'd like to share before we wrap this up?
Would like to let people know that Help for HD is going to be hosting a symposium here on the East Coast.
That's in my announcement. You just did my job.
Okay. I'm going to let you announce
it. I was going to announce it, but you go ahead. You're the one organizing it. This is your... We're so excited to have a symposium outside of California and move to Florida. So, and this is your baby. So you go, you announce it.
Okay. Well, I am really excited about this. On October 8th, which is a Saturday, and for those who live in Tallahassee, it is not a football weekend. There is no home game that weekend. And people in this area will understand why I said that. But we're going to have the symposium at Wakulla Springs, which is a state park, and it has a lodge there. And it's about 15 miles south of Tallahassee. And so we're going to have speakers from all over. We've got Jimmy Pollard coming in from Massachusetts. They're really excited about that. And we've got Peg Napolis coming in from Iowa. And Peg is the one who's doing the Kids JHD and Kids HD programs. So we're really excited that we're going to have her there. And working on getting other speakers as well. So, you know, stay tuned for details on that. We're really excited.
Yes, and the it's a beautiful park, and we're really excited for this event, for sure. It's going to be really great to bring this event. And the great thing about the area is it's so close to other states. So hopefully people come in from New Orleans and all these different areas to be able to come and listen to these speakers talk about Huntington's disease. We're going to have researchers and people in the expert of care, and it's going to be a great day for sure.
Yeah, one of our keynote speakers is from right here in Florida, Dr. Sanchez Ramos from the University of South Florida in Tampa. And a lot of people in the HD community already know him because that's the doctor that they go to. But, yeah, we're in a really good area. We're in the panhandle area of North Florida, right close to the Georgia and Alabama line. So, you know, we've got this tri-state area here, and we're real close to you know, like North Carolina and Mississippi and Louisiana, all of those states, South Carolina, forgot that one, all of those states are within a day's drive, an easy day's drive.
Yeah, and I know that you and Sharon, you and I got to hear Dr. Ramos speak at the Huntington Study Group this year in Tampa, Florida, and he's amazing. He's so wonderful. You know, he was part of an InSweat project where they found the gene. He was part of that group. And the stories he tells from caring for HD patients way back for so long, for his career goes so far back. He's definitely a wealth of information and an excellent speaker. So we are excited he will be there.
And he's not only a doctor, but he's also a researcher. So he'll have interesting things to share about that, too.
Yes, of course. All right. Well, I think we will wrap up the show. I have just a couple of announcements. We only have a couple minutes here. So April 9th, HealthHD International is holding our symposium here in Sacramento. It's just a couple weeks away. Our registration is filling up fast. So please let us know if you will be attending that event. You can email me at katie@help4hd-international.org. And we will get you on the registration list. April 23rd, we have Casino Night Out for JHD, and that's in New Berlin, Wisconsin. So if you're in that area, come on out and join the fun of a Casino Night Out and raise money for JHD research. On May 1st, we have Jackie's Walk for HD, and that is in New York. And then my final announcement is October 8th. We have Tallahassee Symposium in Florida. Thank you guys so much for tuning in this evening, and thank you, Sharon. And everyone have a good night.
Thank you.